prickling with tears. I shake my head impatiently, and the mountains of soap suds rise and fall gently. I'm already home, and I can't bear the thought of moving again. Do you mind coming to me? Not a problem. Your takeout place is better anyway. You sound done in. What time did you get home last night? There's a pause. Ah, you didn't make it home. Well, no. What about you? Were you late? I could lie, now I've become so very good at that. I could obfuscate, I could dodge the question, but it's just so bloody exhausting. I didn't make it home either. Really? But who? I can practically hear her brain whirring. Tom! The surprise is genuine. She has no right to mind, but still, I wonder if she does. Yes. But it's not like that. Not really. What does not really mean? Is she a little forced, or am I overanalyzing? It means I'll tell you later. Not that there's anything much to tell. What time do you think you'll be here? Around 6, I think, if not sooner. My brain is good for nothing today. There's hardly any point in me sitting here. Well, I'll be here, so whenever. I put down the phone and lean my head back against the rim of the bathtub. Severine, dressed in the black shift, has perched her neat behind casually on the edge of the tub, her slender limbs stretched out ahead of her, crossed at the ankle. She turns to look at me expressionlessly, with those dark, all-knowing eyes. It's the contrast that catches attention, I muse, the eyes that have seen far more than fits a face so smooth and unlined. I think of the crow's feet developing round the corners of my eyes, of the single grey hair I found and immediately plucked out last week. I'm 31, I say aloud. Severine is still looking at me. I suppose you'll be, what was it? 19 forever. She looks away, disinterested, presenting me with her profile. Her nose has a small bump in it, but if anything it works for her. It makes her face stronger. Why are you here anyway? She looks at me again. There's no intensity, just a cool appraisal. Then her gaze slides off, as if I'm simply not interesting enough to retain it. It's more than a little galling. I reach for the shampoo and lather up my hair, then try again, irritation creeping into my voice now. Since you're here, do you mind telling me who killed you? She's smoking a cigarette now, one leg crossed over the other, and her sandal dangling off her narrow foot again, in the way that hypnotized Seb all those years ago. She glances at me, one eyebrow raised. It's as strong an expression of amusement as I've ever seen on her face. Yeah, okay, I didn't really think it would be that easy, I mutter. Then I sink under the still hot water to wash out the shampoo. And when I surface, she has gone. So, says Lara expressively, as soon as she has a glass of wine in her hand. So, a single word, two letters, how can it be loaded with such meaning? Spill. She looks tired, so tired that it seems an effort to hold herself together this evening. Even her facial features are rumpled at the edges. I look at the glass in my own hand. It's beautiful. Long and elegant and fragile. A gift, though I don't remember who from. If I applied pressure, it would crack instantly. I have some sympathy. I wonder how resilient Lara is feeling. You spill, I say tightly. I don't mean to be combative, but I sort of do. She takes a sip and tries to smile, but it doesn't come off, and I instantly feel guilty. Are you okay? I ask quietly. She shrugs. Sort of. Maybe. Again, the effortful smile, through tears that can't be far away. You? I shrug. Pretty much the same. Though in my case there are no tears hovering. I won't allow myself to wallow again, I take a sip of the wine. It will go to my head quickly tonight if I'm not careful. Come on, let's order the curry and watch the film. We can do all the spilling later. And so I spend the evening with Lara. It's a nice evening, an evening that harks back to happier times. We watch a rom-com, we eat too much curry, we drink too much wine. It's comforting, this old habit of ours. The only thing that has changed over the years is the quality of the wine. Severine stays away, which isn't really a surprise. I'm well aware she's a figment of my frankly fevered imagination, and my imagination cannot possibly conjure an image of Severine watching anything containing Reese Witherspoon. I see her more as an art house kind of girl. But in truth, more has changed than our wine budget. When the film has finished, we can't avoid the dual elephants in the room. So, she says again, turning to face me and arranging herself cross-legged on the sofa we're sharing. She's borrowed from my wardrobe a pair of slouchy pajama bottoms and a hoodie. On me, they're definitely hide-at-home clothing. But on Lara, they're transformed by her blondness, her bustiness, her sheer wholesome sexiness. She could be an advert for Abercrombie & Fitch. No wonder Tom continues to hold a torch for her. It never bothered me before, but now I find I'm analyzing. Score one for Lara for instant sex appeal. Score one for Kate for her quick intelligence. Score one for Lara. I am appalled at myself. Has one single drunken kiss with Tom really dragged me down to this level? But still I can't completely stifle the ugly green-eyed monster lurking within me. So, I counter, how are things with the dear detective? Ah, she looks down and traces a circle on the sofa with her finger. It's complicated. It seems she's ready to talk. I rearrange myself on the sofa to mirror her position. Where is he tonight? He went back to France. My heart leaps. For good? No, he's coming back on Monday. It's just for some family thing, a christening, I think. Not because of the case. She's still making the circles. Not that he'd tell me if it was because of the case. He won't talk about it with me since... Since? A blush is crossing her cheeks, and suddenly I know exactly what she means. I wonder how she will phrase it. Since we, crossed that line. Bravo, neatly put. I can't bring myself to ask any of the usual gossipy questions, and she doesn't seem to expect me to. She glances up at my face, both embarrassed and rueful, and adds, So, sorry, but no insider information here. A man of principle, I say, only half ironic. He is. She's leaning forward, her whole body imploring me to listen, to understand. I mean, I know how it looks. He's screwing one of the witnesses in his case, but we're keeping it totally separate. He won't discuss it at all with me, not a word. And anyway, it's not like I'm under suspicion. No, but I am. She pauses, then nods dejectedly. Yes, I think you are. It doesn't make any sense to me, given she was alive on Saturday morning. But you are. And Seb, and Caro, and Theo. But me more than most, on account of Seb's complete lack of self-restraint. Tom would be annoyed with me for talking with Lara about this. A streak of rebellion surfaces. Tom is stratospherically annoyed with me anyway, so what the hell? She shakes her head. I don't... Then her blue eyes widen as she twigs. It's a gratifying confirmation that Mordan really isn't talking to her about the case, though I hadn't planned it as a test. Seb and Severine? Really? I would never have guessed that. I mean... I knew he found her attractive. All the guys love a bit of that French ooh-la-la. So predictable. She rolls her eyes. I can't help a private smile at Lara, of all people, who plays the Swedish blonde bombshell angle to maximum effect, being so dismissive of Severine's application of her own cultural advantages. Lara is still absorbing. Wow! What a complete fuckwit Seb is. Was, still is, I should think. She shakes her head again. When did you find out? Just recently. I had started to wonder, and then Seb, apropos of absolutely nothing, admitted it to me last night. Only because he's already told Mordan, and he didn't want me to hear it through that avenue. Lara is frowning. But how? They must have been very discreet. We were pretty much on top of one another in the farmhouse. Apparently it was just the last night. Oh, I suppose it was a pretty crazy night all round. She shakes her head, still digesting. I can't believe I missed that. God, what else did I miss? She means it as a rhetorical question, but it's actually the question, the all-important nub of the matter. Yeah, I've been wondering that myself, I say quietly. You don't mean... But she was alive on the Saturday morning, Lara says impatiently. She got on the damn bus. I nod. Agreed she did, in which case what happened to her has nothing to do with any of us. Or she didn't. It was just a coincidence that someone fitting her description got on at that stop. Hell of a coincidence. How many girls even exist in the world who are that height and build and who wear a red chiffon scarf over their hair? True, but just a coincidence, in which case... I spread my hands and shrug. It seems your Mordan is rather taken with the latter possibility. He's not my Mordan, she protests, though without any conviction. Really? He does seem to be yours. Head to toe, heart and all. I would think so, except... He won't talk about what's going to happen after all this is over and he goes back to France. She looks at me, her eyes overbright. I know he had a long-distance relationship before, and he hated it. It's crazy, I can see it's crazy. We hardly know each other, but... She lifts her hands helplessly, and suddenly I sense her desperate fear. She knows she has already jumped off the precipice. And he won't even talk about it. He just says, we'll figure it out. How are we supposed to do that if he won't talk about it? Maybe he needs to concentrate on one thing at a time. Maybe he just wants to get the case over, so you two can stop skulking around. I can't believe I'm defending the man who seems intent on painting me as a murderer. But I've seen how Mordan looks at her. It's unmissable. It's cinematic. As if he's a reformed alcoholic, and she's the very drink he's been craving for years. That man has no intention of letting her go. Maybe he's worried about how you will feel when he puts your best friend in prison, I add sourly. But she got on the fucking bus! She smacks her hand into the sofa in frustration. I know, but that aside, if you were constructing the case, who would you have as your prime suspect? She pauses, considering. Not Tom, or me, for obvious reasons, and don't think you're off the hook on Tom, I'm coming back to that. And I know it wasn't you, you didn't even know about the affair till just now, so what possible motive would you have? Not a rock-solid basis for excluding me, I tease. Oh, hush. If I'm going to have to think about this, let's not waste time on definite no-nos. Theo, no motive. He knew her forever, and apparently they'd always gotten on well. I'm sure he fancied her, but let's be honest, even if he tried it on and got a knockback, I can't quite imagine Theo summoning up a murderous rage. Fair point. I see Theo, his cheeks flooding pink at the slightest jibe, his back covered in thick Factor 50 to protect the milk-pale skin that is the curse of the true redhead. I cannot imagine Theo, with all his good intentions and awkwardness, having the courage to make a pass at Severine. Come to think of it, I don't remember Theo ever making a pass at anyone. Is it totally un-PC to say I was really surprised about the way he died? Laura asks hesitantly. I didn't know he had it in him. Totally un-PC. But yeah, me neither. Theo died by throwing himself an alive grenade, thereby saving four of his colleagues. I can only imagine it was an instinctive reaction. At the funeral, Tom said that Theo's parents were unimaginably proud, astonished, and despairing, in equal measures. Yeah, she shakes herself after a moment. But anyway, that leaves Caro and Seb. She frowns. I can't see why Caro would, or Seb, but he was with her. I'm quiet, reluctant to influence her thinking. This is a test, in a way, and I'm almost holding my breath. If Lara alights on the same theory that has been slowly building in my subconscious, I can't dismiss it as another product of my demonstrably overactive brain. So, Seb was with her. But why would he kill her? I mean, he wouldn't, not on purpose. Here it comes. God, not intentionally. But what if something happened by accident? Her eyes widen. You know, Kate, it could all have been just a tragic accident. Something went horribly wrong. And rather than face up to it all, he stuffed her body in the well. I mean, he's strong enough. Bingo. We look at each other, wide-eyed. Last night Seb seemed very keen to stress that he came back to the room and passed out, I say quietly. And did he? She asks. I'm not sure. I pretty much passed out myself. He woke me up going to the bathroom at something like 6 in the morning, so sometime before then, I suppose. The clock. Seb stepping out of his boxer shorts, those glowing golden hairs. The clock. Seb. So he could have come in any time before that. I suppose. Only it has just occurred to me that in my memory Seb is on my side of the bed, the side with the chair, where he'd got into the habit of tossing his clothes when he undressed. And he's stepping out of boxer shorts. In the entire time we'd been in France, he'd always grabbed a towel from the hook behind the door and wrapped it round him to go to the communal bathroom, or on occasion, run the gauntlet naked. He'd never ever bothered to fish around for a pair of boxer shorts. Or maybe that was him coming to bed for the first time. I don't know. What do I really remember, and what is a reconstruction? I can't trust in anything anymore. How do you accidentally kill someone? I shrug. Unlucky blow to the head, perhaps? She could have tripped and smacked her head on something. I suppose the autopsy would show that. And how long do you suppose you need to accidentally kill a girl and dump her body? Lara asks, with deliberate drollery. Well, in my vast experience of accidental homicide, I reply, equally drolly. I have definitely had too much wine if I'm being this flippant about the girl that haunts me. Jesus, I don't know. I suppose he must have spent some time screwing her first, though God knows how long that would have taken in his drunken state. And then surely there must have been a period of panic, deciding what to do. She trails off. But you know this is all just a thought exercise. It's not even hypothetical. After all, she got on the bus, right? Her eyes catch mine and hold, and I recognize the uncertainty in them. It matches the tight knot in my belly. She wants me to reassure her. I wanted her to reassure me. And look where that landed me. Right, I say quietly. Chapter 13. I suggest Lara stays the night, half expecting to hear, no thanks, I'd rather wake up in my own bed. But she accepts gratefully. I try to remember the last time she did that. We used to stay with each other a lot in the years just after leaving university, a subconscious attempt to recreate the messy hubbub of student housing, where nobody need ever be alone. It occurs to me that now I am almost always alone, long periods of isolation broken by short human interactions that don't leave me feeling any less solitary. It's probably not good for me. At least, it's probably not good for me that I don't mind. In any case, I think, with dark humour, now I have Severine for company. I have a spare bedroom, but Lara crawls into bed with me like days of old, and turns on her side, resting her head on her bent arm. In the warm glow of the bedside light, I can see her eyeliner is smudged, and her eyelids are heavy with the wine. She looks blousy and sloppy and decadently sexy. Mordan wakes up to this, I think. Does the effect ever wear off? One day will he look at her and move on without lingering, his brain ticking over his to-do list for the day? Or will he always stop for a moment, arrested by the sight, and perhaps touch the back of his hand to her cheek? And Tom, does he remember what she looked like in his bed all those years ago? Does he yearn to see her there now? I cut off that train of thought quickly and turn on my back to look at the ceiling instead. There were times at Oxford and in the years after when I had stabs of jealousy toward Lara, for her effortless magnetism, her easygoing take-it-or-leave-it flirting, for how her very presence dimmed mine in the eyes of the male population. Then I would reason those feelings away. I would console myself that I appealed to the more discerning gentleman. I thought I had grown up, cast off my insecurities. But here we are a decade on. It's so demeaning to realize that actually nothing has changed. Tom, says Lara, uncannily, if sleepily, pulling my gaze back to her. Come on. Time to tell all. I rub a hand over my face, not trusting my voice for a moment, then recover and say, not much to tell. You're pretty upset for not much to tell. I was drunk. Well, we both were. We were sharing a cab and I went up to his flat for a cup of tea. No, really, just tea, I protest on Lara's raised eyebrow. Then somehow, I don't know, we were kissing and then, God, I think I passed out. I pull the pillow over my face. It's beyond humiliating, I say, lifting it enough to let the words out. And then this morning, Tom was livid with me. He thinks I abused our friendship. And he was mean. And it upset me. I shrug and put the pillow down, concentrating on the ceiling. It's fine that he doesn't want anything between us. No, it's not. No, it's not. It doesn't feel fine at all. But he was pretty nasty. It doesn't feel fine to be confessing my humiliation at not being wanted to the girl he really wants either. I wonder if she's pleased that she hasn't been usurped, and then I'm promptly ashamed of myself. Tom, nasty? Lara's eyebrows are raised in astonishment, the hairs glowing golden in the light. Believe me, he's very good at it when he tries, very efficient. Of course he is. Tom is the man who does what needs to be done, no matter what. I know, but nasty to you? What did he say? It doesn't matter. No, really, it doesn't. I shake my head at her. I don't want to drag you into anything. I look at the ceiling again. Does it need repainting? Or is it just that the lamp is casting uneven shadows? I wonder where Severine is sleeping. Does she even sleep? She's only in my head, so I suppose she must sleep when I do, except that I can't imagine that at all. I can imagine her still, even imagine her with her eyes closed, but there's a readiness there, like a panther in repose. At the slightest movement or sound, she would unhurriedly raise her eyelids and survey the surrounds with her dark, secretive eyes. The thought is oddly comforting, like having a guard dog on the premises. Severine, my protector. I almost laugh out loud. Did you want it to turn into anything? Lara asks carefully, after a moment. I turn my head to look at her, but this time she's the one inspecting the ceiling. There are mascara flakes on her eyelashes. I will find smudges on my bed linen in the morning that are hell to get out. You always just seemed like mates. What about Seb? It crosses my mind that Seb never looked to Lara first. Right from our very first meeting, he honed in on me. In retrospect, I wonder if that was part of the attraction. Seb and I broke up a decade ago. She turns her head to look at me with unashamed skepticism, and I can hardly blame her for it. If I didn't know myself that I was over Seb, how could I expect anyone else to? Seb now, he isn't the same as the Seb I knew back then, or thought I knew. I'm not sure Seb was ever who I thought he was. Maybe if I'd seen him in the intervening years, I'd have been over him long ago. Or maybe not. Maybe it's the stark contrast of now versus then that allows me to see things more clearly. Closure, she says thoughtfully. Then again with a tired smile and an American accent. Closure. A large yawn arrives, which she covers delicately, somehow putting me in mind of a cat. And then I think of her again on that car journey back from France, golden and sated, the cat that got the cream. I close my eyes tightly, but the image remains. But Tom, she is saying, did you really want something more? Is she being more or less tenacious than I expect? Is she schooling her expression, or is this a natural reaction? I can't stop the second guessing. God, I don't know. I never thought of him like that, and then suddenly... Was it so sudden? I think of coming to the surface in his car after the journey back from lunch with his folks. Wakey, wakey, sleeping beauty. Of that instant before the world rushed back in. Perhaps that fleeting moment lingered in my head, setting off ripples. I shrug, somehow disturbed by that thought. I don't know. Her yawn is catching. I'm yawning myself now. She says, her eyelids drifting closed. I reach out and flick off the bedside light. How is it that I can feel her warmth stealing across the inches between us, sense the rise and fall of her chest as she breathes evenly? The physical connection, plus the intangible webs that link us. How is it that all of this binds us, yet we're still alone inside our heads? On Monday, Julie has a message for me when I get back to my office after a meeting. Call Caroline Horridge, followed by a Hafton Weil number. There's no message from Tom, not that he would call my office number, and not that I expect him to call at all. I answer a few emails first, but the yellow post-it with Julie's curly script sits on my desk and glares at me unrelentingly until I recognize I'm prevaricating. I grit my teeth, pick up the phone and dial, ignoring Severine, who is lounging against the wall inspecting her fingernails. Carol answers exactly as she always does, stating her name in crisp tones after a single ring. Hi, Carol, it's Kate Channing here, I say breezily, determined to cut off any of her game-playing tactics. You left a message at my office. Nonetheless, she leaves a beat or two, as if even after hearing my full name and exactly why I'm calling, she's still struggling to place me. Ah, yes, Kate, she says warmly, when she finally does speak. Apologies, I've just been immersed in some difficult drafting. Back to the real world, though. I was calling to talk with you about the recruitment progress. I have no idea what she's talking about. In relation to... Hafton Weil, of course. Our recruitment plans. I'm sure by now Gordon has told you that he's handing over the reins of that project to me. My fake smile slides right off my face. He hasn't. Oh, I'm sorry. No, she's not. I didn't mean to jump the gun. Yes, she did. I was sure he'd spoken to you. She knows he hasn't. Well, he has, so you and I are going to be working together on it from now on. She pauses expectantly. Interesting, I say. It is, actually, on a number of levels, but of course she expects something more than that. I recover the fake smile and plaster it on. Well, welcome aboard. I'm sure Gordon would have wanted to tell me himself. I wonder how he will react when he realizes he's been leapfrogged. Thanks. I was hoping you might have some time tomorrow to drop by my office and bring me up to speed. Does that work for you? Absolutely. I glance at my electronic calendar. These days gratifyingly checkered with meetings and calls, my smile doggedly in place. I can do 11 a.m. or any time after 3:30 p.m. tomorrow. Let's do 11 a.m. and then we can grab a bite to eat afterward. Sound good? Perfect, I manage. See you then. Paul comes in just as I'm putting the phone down. Kate, he exclaims. He's definitely on an uptick these days. Glad I caught you. We should discuss the Kavanaugh account, and I really think I'm close to getting Struthers to bite, and... Slow down, I say, laughing. I'm not going anywhere. At least take your coat off first. Severine glances at him with disdain, and suddenly I wonder, if Severine is a creation of my mind, are her reactions my own deeply hidden feelings? I observe Paul as he struggles out of his smart spring raincoat, trying to see him afresh. You could mock him if you wanted to, with his sharp city clothes, his urbane manner, and his unflinching ambition. But I've seen him grey-faced and crumpled with exhaustion on a Friday evening, having worked a 75-hour week. I've drunk champagne out of mugs on the floor of this very office with him. I have no wish to mock him. I'm willing to concede that Severine, this Severine, is my creation, but she's not me. What? Says Paul, looking up to find my eyes on him as he pulls his chair across to my desk. I clear my face. Nothing, nothing, just thinking we've been gratifyingly lucky of late. It's not luck, he says seriously, his vanishingly pale eyebrows drawing earnestly over his eyes. It's hard work. He really, truly believes it. Did I believe that once? Did I think that good things came to those who earned them? Well, I say equivocally, unwilling to burst his bubble. It's both. Mordan, Alan Mordan, investigateur, OPJ, and lover of Lara, a man of many talents. Later that day, I start to realize that one of them is the ability to toss everybody else off balance with an elegantly judged metaphorical tap-tackle. I should think he has put effort into that talent over the years, carefully honing it to cause maximum consternation with minimum effort. He starts this particular campaign with the simplest of requests. A meeting. All of us mind, says Lara again, through the mobile that's clamped between my ear and shoulder to leave my hands free to pack up my briefcase for a meeting. Either she's exceptionally tired or she has just been speaking to her family in Sweden. There's a slight lilt to her voice that only ever comes out in specific circumstances. He says he'd rather not repeat everything 5 times. You don't believe that's the reason, Lara says. It's a statement, not a question. No. I would have expected Mordan to prefer 5 separate interviews, which would provide 5 separate opportunities for analysing reactions, why the change of tack. I pause as I flick through the documents I'm adding to the bag. And neither do you, I suspect. No. She lets out a long sigh that sweeps through the city and delivers her frustration into my ear. It's infuriating. I give up on choosing which documents I need and just drop them all in. No, well it is, but mostly it's just unsettling. He's lying. I know he's lying. He knows I know he's lying. I think he even wants me to know he's lying. Like that makes it less awful or something. How the hell are we supposed to base a relationship on this? You're not, I say sweetly, snapping the briefcase shut. That's why policemen aren't supposed to fraternize with witnesses. Oh, fuck off, she says, half laughing. I shall. I've got to run to a meeting. I switch the mobile into my hand. Listen, Lara, this will pass. It won't be like this forever for you guys. You just need to ride it out as best you can. I know. This time the long sigh curls around me, heavy and brooding. The sunshine girl is fast losing her son. If this thing runs for another 2 years, it doesn't bear thinking about. Well, I'll see you there, tonight, at 6:30. Got it. And everyone is coming? I ask this as casually as I can, but of course Lara isn't fooled. Yes, though now I don't know who you're most worried about seeing, Seb or Tom.
Carol, actually, I say dryly. Always Carol.
It's 6:30 p.m., and we are meeting at the enormous 1960s glass and concrete monstrosity that is New Scotland Yard, the home of the Met Police. I didn't pay much attention to that when Lara gave me the details over the phone, but now, standing outside by the familiar triangular sign that I must have seen in thousands of TV news items, I feel the knot in my stomach tighten. Mordan is not just the tricky Frenchman who's screwing my best friend. He's a man with the weight of the law behind him, both the law of his own country and of mine. Recognizing that this intimidation is intentional doesn't make it any less effective. I look around in the vain hope that perhaps Lara might be arriving at just this moment, and we can brave it all together. But no, I am on my own. I square my shoulders and push through the door. The inside is sparse and clean and hard-edged, but I'm not really in the frame of mind to take much note. The solid-faced uniformed officer behind the reception desk is expecting me. Within minutes I'm led into a conference room with a pine-effect conference table and 12 chairs. Surely 6 too many, clustered around it, though none of those chairs are currently occupied. You're the first, says the officer, pointing out the obvious. His tone is cheerful, but his face doesn't change. Perhaps that's what a career in the police does to you, though Mordan seems to have retained the faculty of facial expression. I'm sure Detective Mordan will be along shortly. There's a coffee machine just down the hallway on the right, if you're so inclined. Then I'm alone with the functional furniture. I drop my handbag onto one chair and look around. The grey London street beyond the window is slightly distorted. I wonder if the glass is bulletproof. It's certainly soundproof. I can't hear the traffic at all. From the hallway I can hear the muffled buzz and chatter of life continuing. But in here, both I and the oversized room seem to be holding our breath, as if suspended before the roller coaster drops. Then I hear Tom's distinctive rumble and Lara's giggle. I feel a sudden lurch as the roller coaster picks up speed again, and then they spill into the room with Seb on their heels. I put all my focus on Lara, absurdly self-conscious as I hug her in greeting, but I can't hide in our hello forever. I have to release her and turn to Tom and Seb. Both of them step forward at the same time, but then Tom gestures awkwardly and steps back, leaving the field for Seb. Hello, Seb, I say neutrally. Behind him I can see Carol enter the room, her blonde hair pulled back into a severe chignon.
Kate, says Seb warmly, though perhaps I detect a touch of apprehension lurking in his eyes. Good to see you, though of course I'd rather we were in a pub or something.
He leans in to kiss me on each cheek. I stay still throughout, imagining my cheeks are marble, and all the while I'm looking at Tom, who in turn is looking at Seb and me with a shuttered expression. When his eyes catch mine, he immediately glances away. And Carol watches us all. Hello, Tom, I say quietly, crossing to him.
Hi, Kate, he says, not quite meeting my eye. Then he leans in and kisses me on both cheeks. Tom, who never kisses. Tom, who always hugs. Yet again, my cheeks are marble, this time not in silent protest, but because it's all I can do to hold myself in one piece. I can feel I'm beginning to tear apart, and I don't know how to sew myself back together. Tom, I start when he steps back, but Seb is talking over me.
Christ, I need a coffee, he's saying. Shall I grab you one, Tom?
I'll come with you, Tom says quickly, with what sounds suspiciously like relief. I watch the two of them leave together, and for a moment I see them as a stranger might. Two men similar enough around the eyes and in frame as to be brothers, though very different in colouring. Seb always seemed older, and he seems older still, but that's no longer a compliment. A decade ago he was a man among boys, but now he is a man hurtling more quickly toward middle age than the rest of us. In the light of day, there's a slackness to him that becomes more noticeable next to Tom's clean bulk. Caro is speaking to Lara and me, whilst simultaneously fishing something out of her slimline soft leather briefcase.
God, I thought I'd never get here on time. I was leading a negotiation for a major client. I couldn't really just up and leave.
I feel my jaw clench. Not just a client, a major client. Not just in a negotiation, but leading it. It's petty and mean and plain exhausting to be so attuned to the slightest word or expression, but I just can't stop myself. Perhaps it's just not within me to gift Caro with the benefit of the doubt.
Anyway, she says, finally looking up, blackberry in hand, how are you two?
Fine, says Laura brightly.
Just, oh, here's Alan.
I turn to see him pause at the doorway, an elegant grey suit encasing his long limbs, accentuated today by a powder blue tie. His eyes scan the room and stop on Lara momentarily, just long enough for something to pass between them that I could almost reach out and touch, then resume their survey. Finally, he steps forward.
Ladies, he says, a smile lurking at the edge of his mouth. And gentlemen, he adds, as Tom and Seb return with their coffees.
They each deposit their cardboard cups on the table to shake his hand. I notice that he didn't shake hands with Carol, Lara, or me.
Welcome to the glamour that is New Scotland Yard, he says, with an ironic lift of his eyebrows.
Are police stations in France similar? Asks Lara.
He considers this seriously.
Oui, in many ways, though.
He looks at the flimsy cups on the table and wrinkles his nose in distaste.
The coffee is better.
This is greeted with great hilarity. We are all too tense, too desperate in our efforts to project good-humoured ease.
And the food is better. And the decor. And the furniture. So, maybe no. Nothing like the same.
He smiles, acknowledging the laughter his words have elicited, deep lines bracketing his mouth. I haven't seen him in this kind of environment before, where he has an audience and it's his show. I can see that he and Lara are birds of a feather. They wear their skin with such effortless charm. He glances round as if performing a head count.
Alors, we are complete. Please, sit.
So we sit. Modan at the head of the table, Lara and I on one side, and Tom, Seb and Caro, and her Blackberry, on the other. It's a split that's reminiscent of the divisions during that fateful week in France. It doesn't feel accidental. Caro is the last to choose a chair. I see her evaluating the options. The artificial light reveals shadows under her eyes that even her careful application of concealer has failed to hide. And there's a grey tinge to her skin. Exactly what I'd expect for a lawyer in the run-up to partnership. As she settles into the seat next to Seb, I try to step outside of myself, to see her as I might if she was a prospective candidate to be placed through my firm. But I can't do it. My dislike of her is too pervasive. I disliked Severine too, but that was in life. I'm growing accustomed to her in death. I can't imagine that she would miss this. And sure enough, there are only 5 chairs too many. Severine has settled herself in one at the far end of the table. Her face doesn't betray any interest. Of course it doesn't. This is Severine. But there's a stillness within her that gives her away.
"We are complete," says Mordan again, when everyone is settled.
I see Tom glance around the group, and a brief flash of despair crosses his face before he schools it back into submission. Perhaps there are only 4 chairs too many. I don't expect Severine has the monopoly on haunting.
"Alors, thank you, all of you, for coming."
He looks around the table slowly, his long face grave. Opposite me, Tom and Seb have both pushed their chairs back from the table and have their long legs stretched out. I wonder if they teach it in public school, this ability to take ownership of a room by an elegant display of casual relaxation. For whose benefit is the display in Tom's case? Mine or Mordan's?
"I wanted to tell you all together that we now have the results of the autopsy on Mademoiselle Severine."
I glance across the table and see Seb look up sharply, his hand tightening on the coffee cup. By contrast, Tom continues to look as if Mordan is merely discussing the weather, and not terribly interesting weather at that.
"The conclusion is that she died by what you here call foul play."
I wait for him to continue, but he simply looks around the room again, overlooking no one.
"You didn't get us all here just for that," I say abruptly. "I'm tired. At least I'm tired of the showmanship. And I'm upset, and I'm not censoring myself quickly enough."
Lara puts a hand on my arm, but it fails to halt me.
"Seriously, she ended up concertinaed at the bottom of a well. How could it not be foul play?"
Mordan frowns.
"Concertinaed? What is this?"
Lara reels off something in rapid-fire French. Mordan's expression clears.
"Ah, I understand."
He tries out the new word.
"Concertinaed. Yes, indeed, a fair point, though of course we always have to rule out suicide or accident."
He pronounces the last word in the French fashion, but I'm still caught on the incongruity of suicide. I stamp down on the highly inappropriate urge to laugh. Had he seriously considered the possibility she stuffed her own self in the well? I glance down the table, and Severine's dark eyes gleam as they meet mine. Quite apart from the logistical difficulties of that particular theory, we both know she's not the suicidal type.
"But you are right, there is more," Mordan continues, unaware of the weight of Severine's dark eyes upon him.
Across the table, Caro has her head cocked, her body leaning forward and Blackberry forgotten. A textbook example of a person listening intently. Because she is, or because that's what she wants to portray. Tom and Seb are still sprawled out, but the tension in Seb is obvious. He doesn't have Caro's inherent artifice.
"After this length of time, unless the body is somehow preserved, the autopsy can have a nil result. Inconclusive, yes? In this case, we have a body that's spent 10 years in a warm, mainly dry environment, which is the most efficient environment for leaving just the bones."
Beside me, Lara shudders, the most minute of movements, but nonetheless Mordan picks up on it. I wonder if he would have had it been Caro or myself doing the shuddering.
"I apologize, this is not a pleasant topic, but it is necessary. So, I was saying, there are just bones."
He spreads his hands.
"Broken bones."
"Broken?" asks Laura. "From what?"
"We cannot tell if the breaks are pre- or post-mortem."
He shrugs, his fingers flexing out briefly in a synchronized movement.
"They would fit very well with a car crash,
He searches for a word for a moment, then snaps his fingers. A hit and run! Across the table I see Tom's gaze sharpen and jump sharply to Mordan. In less than a blink, that horned focus is gone, and once again, he's the only casually interested observer he has been all along. Tom is surprised by something. It's the first time I've detected surprise in him since Severine was found.
Or, continues Mordan, they could have occurred when the body was put in the well. Concertinaed, as Kate says.
He inclines his head in my direction. There's no smile lurking around his mouth. That would be in terribly poor taste. But I know it's inside him.
So you're saying, says Caro, her expression clinically professional, that you have no evidence of cause of death? In which case, shouldn't you pack up and go home?
Lara's hand tightens on my arm. Mordan doesn't look at her.
Regrettably, no. He adds a theatrical sigh. You are correct, we do not have cause of death. But we do have her bones. The human body is amazing.
He shakes his head a little, half smiling.
Truly amazing. Even after death, it still finds ways to speak to us.
Tell me about it, I think, with dark humor. Severine's bones are far too communicative as far as I'm concerned, though I imagine they are communicating with Mordan through a somewhat different method.
We have her bones, and what they tell us is that Severine was not at the bus depot on the Saturday morning.
What? Says Lara, confused. But the CCTV...
Mordan is shaking his head.
Not her, no. Similar height, similar build, similar, thing with the scarf.
He twirls a hand expressively above his head.
But not her. The proportions are wrong. I cannot translate the technical details, but there is something with the length of one bone in relation to another one, along with photographs. Ah, the experts, they are absolutely certain. Absolument. It is not Severine on the CCTV.
And so, it was one of us. His words plow into me with the weight of a wrecking ball. Somewhere inside I've been expecting this, dreading this. It was one of us. Like the discovery of her body in the well, it suddenly seems inevitable, unavoidable, obvious. One of the five of us, six including Theo, killed Severine. For all one could construct a theory to say otherwise, I now believe it with a sickening certainty that is absolute, as if I've always believed it. I look around the table and see varying degrees of shock on the faces. Lara is still stuck on what he actually said. The full implication hasn't hit her yet. I hear her mutter, "Hell of a coincidence." Tom is very, very still, but behind those hooded eyes I imagine the activity is frenetic. Caro says,
"Really? You're sure?"
To which Mordan nods, and then she steeples her hands and props her chin on them, frowning thoughtfully. And Seb looks tired, grey, defeated. He looks like he's been dreading this too.
"Alors," says Mordan, not quite spelling it out. "The five of you were the last to see Mademoiselle Severine alive."
"And Theo, of course," interjects Caro casually. Tom stiffens at this and casts her a dark, thoughtful look. And I know why. The games have begun, if they hadn't already. We're now in a macabre version of Pass the Parcel. When the music stops, nobody wants to be left holding this prize. It would be incredibly convenient for all if Theo, the only person whose life can't be wrecked, were to shoulder the blame. But as I look at Tom, I can't imagine he will allow that without a fight. I look around the table again. It's impossible not to think, as each face passes under my gaze, Was it you? Could you have done it? And most disturbing of all, how far will you go to blame someone else? When I get to Severine, she returns my gaze coolly, then slides down her chair and tips her head back, closing her eyes, sunbathing. Severine and Lara, I think bleakly, the only people I believe are innocent, and one of those is the victim, and, moreover, dead. Mordan inclines his head to Caro in agreement.
Oui, of course, and Theo, too. I'm afraid I will need to conduct more interviews, but as we are all here, first I thought we might try to properly establish the timelines at night. It's a little...
his expressive hands dance.
Unclear, at the moment.
Seb starts to say something, but Tom leans forward suddenly, giving up all pretense of disinterest, and speaks over him.
Should we have lawyers present?
His words hang in a silence that is only broken by Lara's sharp intake of breath. She has finally caught on. I look at Tom speculatively for a moment. I spoke with my own lawyer only hours before this meeting, and her instructions had been very explicit. If you must go at all, just observe, listen, and whatever you do, don't answer a damn question without me present. I wonder if Tom has taken legal advice too. Mordan stretches out his long arms and tweaks at one of his cuffs before answering.
If you wish, you can certainly have a lawyer present, so you are not under arrest. Of course,
he spreads his palms.
This is just a fact-finding, no? And of course you all want to be helpful, cooperative. Waiting for lawyers,
he rolls his eyes expressively.
Well, it is rather a waste of time.
I can't help admiring his performance, even as the intent chills me.
Still, says Tom robustly, obviously I can't speak for everyone, but I think I'd rather take legal advice at this point.
In phrasing it like that, I can't speak for everyone. He is somehow speaking for us, as if he's created a group mentality by the mere suggestion that there could be one. He stands, pushing his chair back abruptly with the action.
And if we're not under arrest, then of course we're free to go at any point, correct?
And just like that, he has wrested the power from Mordan, and the meeting is over. Chapter 14. We loiter outside the police station, a reluctant group, unwilling to depart, but equally unwilling to engage in conversation. Lara breaks the silence.
It's real now, isn't it? She says, almost as if she's talking to herself. We can't pretend this isn't serious anymore.
I can't...
She trails off. Seb speaks into the void she's created.
Anyone know a good lawyer?
He aims for a joking tone and directs the question toward Caro and me, but he looks anything but playful. It seems to me I can see straight through to the skeleton beneath his surface. The muscle and skin and tissue are just window dressing draped on the bones of him. He might unravel at any moment.
Criminal law's not really my area, I reply. I try to inject some humour myself. Though if you're looking for a good corporate lawyer, I'm absolutely the person to talk to.
Nobody bothers to honour my effort with even a smile. Caro is already back on her BlackBerry. She speaks without looking up.
I'm sure my dad will be able to come up with someone.
Or your dad, she adds, as an afterthought. Seb grimaces.
Yeah. Really looking forward to that conversation.
Tom glances across with a sympathetic twist of his mouth. Seb's father's influence has clearly not waned over the years.
Caro's head lifts at that. Come on, Seb, don't let Mordan rattle you. I mean, he has nothing. Nothing! No physical evidence at all and just a load of conjecture.
She looks round the group impatiently. None of us have anything to worry about. This is all going to go away.
Or linger on forever, says Lara darkly. She glances back at the entrance to the